question and answer period, and that is to tell you that if I don't know the answer, I'll say I don't know.
What are some of the things you look for when you're trying to find a good Christian school?
A good Christian school, there are three categories of schools that are available to you. One is a government school, which from my perspective, most of the time, not all the time, is the least desirable. Because of two things. One, the atmosphere, the environment, and two, more than that for me, is the curriculum base. There are a lot of people who have their children in government schools, and it's not my responsibility to tell them what to do, and I don't feel negative toward them. That's their business, and it's something that you have to decide for your family and your circumstances. A lot of people raise their family in public schools, government schools, and they live for the Lord. You know, you don't have to just that kind of thing. That's not the issue. Is not being hysterical about something. The issue is just trying to be rational about it and do the best you can under the situation, under the circumstances, and the context in which you live. Then there's Christian schools, which are also public schools. They're open to the public. And one said the government schools were run by the government. The Christian schools were run by Christian ministries, churches, and things. And then there's what's called there are genuinely private schools, which would be homeschooling. And that's basically about the three options you have today. I would look within that context and find, you know, what my capabilities are. My children have always been in a Christian school. My wife and I made a commitment to that many years ago before they got in school. And we've made a lot of real sacrifices to keep them there. They've been in good ones and they've been in bad ones. They've been in some Christian schools that I didn't think were any better than the government schools. And they didn't stay there. I took them out. But I think what we look for is first a good academic base where they're going to be taught the things that they need to manipulate in life. That being there, then I look for a spirit of discipline, what I would call discipline under grace. My children were in a school one time where everything was, you were beat into doing everything. It's only one time have I ever had my kids in a school like that. A lot of Christian schools are this way. They set up standards. If you're going to be spiritual, you can't have long hair and you can't have short hair. What do you got to have hair like? Well, whatever the principal says. You can't wear bell-bottom pants. You can't, you know, that kind of stuff. You can't wear a mustache. You can't have this. You can't have that. You can't have wire-rimmed glasses. You know, what's all that got to do with anything? But that's spirituality. Well, I'd avoid that like the plague if I could. You can't always. Life, you see, you can't run, you can't go out of the world. So what you want to do with your children is to teach them to live in the world, but not to be of the world. And you're the one going to do that. You don't worry. The television, the schools, and all the rest don't have the impact on your kids you do. They have an impact. And if you're not careful, they can have too much of an impact or a wrong impact. But that's you having the impact. That's you not having the impact you ought to have. So I'd look for a spirit of, rather than we're going to beat you into subjection, one that would take children and lead them to achieve the issues of, the big thing is separation from the world, but to do that not because you're beating them into not doing something, that's the law, but that you're helping them grow into something that's so much better. That's grace. I think for me that's a real important thing. I'm not afraid of my children being taught evolution. That's the big thing in the public schools now. You know, I'm going to learn evolution, Mom. I hope they learn something about it, because the more they learn about it, the more nuts they'll know it is. And you have to take responsibility to teach them those things. If you'll center your family and your life day in and day out around the things of the Lord, and live, a husband and wife live together under grace, not under the not under. Every time somebody doesn't live up, you know, setting all these expectations, and he didn't live up to the expectations, so I'll burn supper tonight, and I'll get him. And therefore, teach your children that that's the way you should live. Not living like, but love, live in a spirit of love and harmony together, and handle problems. The greatest thing people, the greatest deficiency in personal lives that people have today is most of you people right here don't know how to solve problems when they come up in your life. It's amazing to me. People come to me and they sit down and we talk about family problems. And they don't have any idea. They can't even hardly identify the problem, much less know how to solve it. Well, teach your children how to solve problems by... I used to sit my kids down, teach them an hour worth of Bible every night. And the little guy sitting there, you know, I said, sit on that couch. See, I've always told my kids, you sit there and be still. They sit there and be still. I got in trouble one time in church, and we moved to Chicago, and my little guy, my oldest boy was about 9. The next one was about 6. The next one was just a baby, and the 6-year-old, they sat on the third pew from the front with my wife, and I was preaching, and the 6-year-old got up and started to walk out. And I stopped and I said, boy, where are you going? I gotta go to the bathroom, baby. I said, you sit down there and hold it. God gave you muscles to take care of that. Okay. And he went and sat down. Boy, I mean, I caught the dickens from the little old ladies in the church, you know. And they didn't understand. I told them, I said, now, wait a minute. I've taught this child, you know, not for years, because he's not years old, but I'm teaching him that you don't, just every time you think maybe you got to go to the bathroom, you don't have to go right that minute. Now, you understand that. And he needs to understand there are things going on that he's not interested in. I never met a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old that likes sitting in church. But that had nothing to do with it. Look, kid, we do a lot of things for you that I'm really not interested in. But I do them because I love you and I know you are. This is for grown-ups. And you're going to sit there and you're not going to cause them trouble. And you're not going to kick the bench. You're not going to make a scene. You're going to sit there because that's what's right and that's what we do. And by the way, we go to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. That means you go to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. Got that? Yeah. We sit in church as a family. Got that? Yeah. Okay. And it's just who you are, so they learn to be who they are. And I think that that's, regardless of where you wind up with your children in school, when your children are my age, there are a lot of my kids' age, there's a lot of things that they want and so forth, and social things and things that make a lot of determinations about some of those things. But by the time my oldest boy is 20, wants to get married next year, and I was sitting with him and his intended, they wanted me to counsel them, you know. And so the first time I sat down with them to talk about it, I told them, I said, you know, there's not a whole lot I can tell you about being a husband. I mean, you've lived with me for 20 years, and if I haven't in 20 years taught you how to love your wife by you watching me love my wife, and how to be a husband to a wife, there's nothing I'm going to say to you in 10 minutes or in 10 hours. See, because he has a unique relationship. He's my son. And that's what you want to shoot. They're going to be more affected by that than anything. So just settle down. Don't get all excited. Don't expect your kids to be something you're not. Perfect. You're not, and they aren't going to be. And don't think that one mistake that they make or that you make is going to destroy all of life. It doesn't do that. When you get to a decision where when you make this decision, it destroys all of life, there have been 100 little ones that led up to that. See, what you want to do is just be consistent over the long haul. If you blow up and you make a mistake, what do? Then you've got an opportunity that you didn't have before. You've got the opportunity to teach your children how to handle mistakes. Do you understand how important that is? Under grace, the issue is mistake or I'm going to whack you. It's you make mistakes and I fixed it for you. That's what God says. So when you make a mistake, instead of shifting the blame to somebody else, instead of denying that there's a mistake, instead of covering up, making all these excuses, just teach the child how to handle a problem. You face it. You bear all of your responsibility. You look for everything you can be responsible for, because if you can be responsible for it, you can be a part of the solution. If you're not responsible for it, you're just butting in where you don't belong. Now see, everybody likes to go, the husband likes to butt in to where his wife is and tell her where she's responsible and try to fix it for her, and she likes to butt in where he is and try to fix it for him. And so what does the kid learn to do? Same thing. But if you learn to be responsible for you first, and then assist the other person to be responsible for them, but you be responsible for you first, then you're you can work through the things. And I think those are the keys. And that's what he says in Ephesians 4:6-4. Man, that's a good verse. When it comes to child raising, gentlemen, it's always the daddy that's addressed. Never addresses the mother. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. You know how to provoke your kid to wrath? What is it? What does Paul say that works wrath? That's right. Romans 2:15. The law works wrath. Don't put your children under a law principle. Does that mean you don't have rules and regulations? I mean, come on, be serious about this. It's the law principle. It's if you don't live up to the standard I set, I'm going to reject you, condemn you, destroy you, throw you out. Condemnation, condemnation, condemnation. Put them under grace. Bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Nurture, that which produces growth. You know what that is. If you're going to make a tree grow, what do? You fertilize it, but you also prune it. You give freedom within defined boundaries. You see, that's what God always did. You know what ultimate freedom is? It's in the Garden of Eden. God said you can eat of any tree of the garden, you can freely eat except one. He gave them absolute total freedom within defined boundaries. That's what it's all about. That's always the way things are. That's what he did under the law. He just constricted the boundaries down real tight. He said, you can't eat this, this, and this, but you can eat this, 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 and this. But did he tell them what they had to eat today? You can eat any one of these five things. You can't eat those four things, but you can eat any of these five things. Now, what are we going to have for supper? It's your choice. Don't eat those. You can't choose from those, but you can choose from these. You see, there's freedom, but the bounds are real constricted. Now, under grace, the bounds are real big. You've got some limitations. You've got some the works of the flesh. Can't be that. But within this circle of things that are there, it's up to you. Can you imagine? I use this illustration because I thought about it the other night. Can you imagine Adam and Eve? The very first evening, Adam's off, naming the animals. Been a big day for Adam, man. I mean, he took a little siesta at lunch and he woke up and there's this gal that he never saw before. Wow, man, where you been, babe? it's love at first sight. For both of them. She looks at him and says, you're the only man in the world for me. And she goes home in the evening, and he says, you go home, and I'm going to go out, and I got work to do. I got some animals to watch and observe and try to figure out some names for. And I'll bring groceries home, and we'll have supper tonight. So he comes in the evening with two big bags of fruit. And he puts them on the kitchen table and says, well, I picked some apples, and I picked some oranges, and I picked some cantaloupe, some figs, and some dates. puts them all on the table here, and he's got some big, beautiful red apples and some yellow apples, and, you know, he's got them all out there, and apples were not the forbidden fruit, by the way. He says, now, God said that we could eat of any of the fruit of the garden except that one, and I didn't go anywhere close to that grape tree, that grapevine over there. I laid off that. Any of these are okay. I'm going to go take a shower, get cleaned up, you fix supper. Can you imagine what Eve looking at that, and she says, you know, she comes, Adam, dear. Here comes Adam. Yes, you know, he's got one shoe off coming in. And you know, sugar, I want the first meal to be just right. Would you mind going over to the Lord's house and asking him which of these fruit he'd like for us to, you know, I want to pick just the one that would be God's will for us to eat tonight. It's our first meal together. And I want my first decision to be the right one. I want to be right in the center of what God wants. Would you mind going over and asking him which one of these fruit he would like for us to eat tonight? Well, for you, sugar, anything. So off Adam goes. You know what he would have come, what he came back with? He says, well, what did he say? What did he say? Well, he said that of any of the fruit of the garden we can freely eat except that one. And I didn't eat any of that. Didn't get any of that. He just said any of them. Okay. So he goes down, gets his shoes off, and goes sit down by the river, you know, and he's got his feet in the river and cooling them off. And, Adam! So he comes back in. She says, well, we'll have these apples because you like them so much. But I wonder how God would have us to cook them. I mean, I want to do just what God wants. I could bake them. I could make a pie. I could make a cobbler. And she lists about 10 different ways you could cook the apples. I wonder just how God would prefer we prepared them. Would you mind going over and asking him? So, you know, Adam, being the nice husband that he is, off he goes again. Sweet, loving, kind Adam. Comes back, and he says, you know, I'm thinking about this. I asked him, and you know what he said? He said the same thing he'd said before. Of any of the trees of the garden, you can eat freely. You know, sugar, I think I'm getting the idea that he doesn't care which one we eat, as long as we don't eat that one. And she says, you mean we can, all those different things, he doesn't care which one? And we can eat them any way we want to eat them? Yeah. She says, gee. Adam says, I'm catching on. I tell you what, wife, let's have fruit salad. What's a salad? You know, she's just new on the scene. You get the idea that I'm trying to get across to you is that within that circle, there's liberty to make. And what you want to do with yourself and with your children is to teach them to recognize where the circle is, and then to learn to make wise decisions in the circle. Okay? Now, that's a different kind of answer than anybody ever gave you before about that, I know. You know, it would be easy for me to tick off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things about school, this kind of, that kind of thing. I said, you do this, you're in the will of God, you do that, you're not. I can't tell you that. Nobody can tell you that. Sir, the way God communicates his will to you is that book, Rightly Divided. It's written down black and white. There's no questions about it. You have to take that, and with your renewed mind, a mind educated with the doctrine of grace, circumstances and feelings are not means of divine communication to you. They're not authoritative revelations of the will of God to you. That isn't how God communicates to you. He communicates through that word. What your circumstances and what your feelings are, your circumstance, they're the context in which you have to make decisions. Now, the context determines what decisions are made. Sometimes one decision in one context is one thing. Another context is another. You ride up to a red light, an intersection, and there's a light, and the light's red. In that context, what do you do at that intersection? You stop. If the light's green, in that context, what do you do in that intersection? See? That's when it's yellow. No, green, okay. I mean, we came up, we went through an intersection yesterday, and we start stopping, and Tom looks in the mirror, and the truck behind us, he wasn't stopping. And it was pretty obvious if we stopped in order, before the light, the truck was going to stop right on top of us. So you know where we wound up stopping? The other side of the intersection. Because Tom keeps looking in the mirror. And then a guy starts hollering at us. Try to cause a wreck. No, we're trying to stay out of one. See? In that man's eyes, you're doing... But in the context from the way we were seeing what was really happening, there was something else. So the context can determine the way you apply. Sometime in one situation, do one thing. But you've been given a renewed mind to determine those things and make those choices. And as long as it's within the revealed limits, any one of those choices, you're free to make. So you're free to do what is best, what Paul calls the spiritual expedient. That is that which is going to produce the thing that is to the best advantage of you, your family, your children, your circumstances, the brethren, whatever, to the best way to get the job done. And you're free to do it in your case, and I'm free to do it in my case, and he's free to do it in his case. And his decision might be different from mine, but if it's done that way, it's just as good as mine, and it's just as right as mine. That's why I don't have any ability. When we make those decisions, I can't say I'm right and you're wrong. If you violate something, that's different. That's the issue of developing convictions. Every man should be fully persuaded in his own mind. You are responsible to develop your own convictions, not live by mine. Develop your own convictions about a matter. Live by your convictions, not by other people's, and not require other people to live by yours. And if you'll do that in your life and teach your children by your doing it, to do that. It isn't going to be where they go to school that's going to make or break them. Is that making any sense to you?
I was wondering, in light of how you're saying to make a decision, I just asked the question on behalf of others. We have a man today, his own son is getting married, and for months it's been burdened on his mind. On his participation in the wedding, he doesn't like the idea or a son had made a profession of faith years ago and marrying a non-believer, and he doesn't want to be a part of the wedding, yet they're going to be hurt, and they're saying you don't have any Christian love if he's not part of the wedding. In what you're discussing right there, think out his options and use the Word of God to show where he's actually making decisions.
That's the process of decision making. The goal in the Christian life is to make wise decisions. That's your goal. The goal is not to find some dot in the center of a circle somewhere. The dot doesn't exist. All it's been is about the Lord leading me to do this. The Lord never led you to do any of that. That isn't how God leads people. I mean, and I say that. I can say that absolutely, categorically, no fear of contradiction from the book. Now, I know people say that. We use those terms, you know. Oh, God, I want you to... I'm praying, oh, Lord, today that you'd... I got to buy a car. Oh, God, I pray that you'd lead me just to the right car that you'd have for me. I'm sorry, that's just stupid. That's praying an unintelligent prayer. That's praying... dumb, stupid praying. That's all that is. That's not intelligent praying. Now, is that okay to pray unintelligently? Sure. Is it smart? No. Is it helpful? No. Does God get mad at you when you do it? No. He can hold it against you. But he sure wants you to do better. I mean, we don't know what to pray for as we ought, but you ought to know better than You see, within the realm of things, God didn't care if Mike had a black shirt and Brother Frank had a brown coat and I got on, I don't even have on a tie, and I got a jail stripe. You know why I got that shirt? I went through Kohl's the other day in Chicago and they had these shirts on sale for $4.95 and I bought two of them. You know why I bought two of them?
One to cover the other one up with.
Somebody take him home, would they? That's like O'Hare one time. He had a tie on, and he had it stuck over on this side of his, you know, and it was crooked. And somebody came up to him, and they said, "Oh, Brother O'Hare, your tie is crooked. Let me straighten it." He said, no, I got it covering up the egg. I bought it because I needed some shirts, and there were, I could buy a $20 shirt for $5. I didn't buy it because I like the way it looked. I don't mind the way it looks. And if it agitates Mike, I like the way it looks.
I didn't think you'd let me off the hook.
Yeah, okay. You're thinking through the thing. Now, when it comes to your children and things like that, you know, boy, that's tough. It would all depend on the situation and the circumstances. If I had a child, was going to marry an unbeliever, they would have to know way before they ever decided to do it, before they ever started dating them, I'd be dealing with them about, I've got two teenagers, and one that's fixing to be, one's fixing to get out of the teenagers, one fixing to come in. They don't make major decisions in their life that I'm not involved in. I just don't let it happen. So by the time that child came to the place where he was going to decide that he's going to date somebody, wanted to date somebody, I was going to know about them. I was going to be involved in that. So if there came a place where he's going to marry an unbeliever, he and I long ago would have had the thing settled. I'm not going to be a part of this. I'm opposed to it. It is wrong. This isn't who we are as a family. This isn't the thing. This is not what our convictions are. And I can't be a part of it. They would want me to marry him. I couldn't marry him. I love you. Has nothing to do, and I love the girl, and I'm for you, and I want you to have a, and if you're never going to talk somebody out of getting married. Now, you can forget that now. You're never going to do it. I've been preaching over 20 years. I've never seen anybody get talked out of getting married when they thought they were in love, or when they were. What you want to do is have a posture so that after the love is blind, marriage is a great eye-opener, after you hit the wall, that you're there to be able to do something to help them, you know? I mean, I just tell people, look, I don't do a lot of marriage counseling ahead of time. I do it after. You ain't going to listen to me now anyway. 3 months after, you're going to be ready to listen. 6 months after, you're going to want to listen. A year after, you're going to be coming to me. So I honestly do most of that afterwards, because I've never seen anybody that I thought shouldn't marry communicate that to them that it made any difference. Honestly, I never have. So, I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm just saying I never saw it. But what I'm saying with in my situation, the way it would work out is that there'd be a long, by the time it got to here, they would understand where I was. And in that situation, I probably would go to the service myself, sit. But see, I'm in a unique situation. If I were at one of my son's wedding and was not performing the ceremony, it would be obvious that I wasn't for the thing. That would be a way to communicate to them for me. And if I sat in the back of the building instead of joining in all the festivities, and I was there with a heavy heart rather than the happy heart that I'd want to have, a sad happy heart. Because on one level, it's a wonderful thing. On another level, man, you're buying trouble. You're buying an Edsel. And maybe you can make a Lincoln out of it one day. Maybe God will change it, but God's the one got to change it. And if you want God to change it, don't do it different than the way He wants it. Don't screw it up and then say, "Lord, you straighten it up." So, you know, you just communicate that to them. And if they're determined to do it anyway, then you just have to love them. Let them understand, hey, you've disappointed me. This is different than who I am. But you're grown. And you have to stand before God, and I have to be me before the Lord. You're my child, but you're also a responsible person before God. And if you make the choice to do it, I'm not going to treat you any different than anybody else that does things. And if the man ever went to a wedding of unsaved people, then he can't say, I'm not going to go to your wedding because you married somebody unsaved. Because he's done that. Business associates, friends, and acquaintances. It's not a consistent. Now, you can say, hey, they were just acquaintances and so forth. And because of our relationship, in other words, the problem isn't going to an unsaved person's wedding if he's been to others. The problem is it's my son. And I don't know. I can't tell you. Circumstances, one circumstance could mean you could, another not. Now, if you just woke up and you haven't developed this situation, and this all of a sudden a guy walks in and says, you know, he's been living out on his own for a couple of years, and he comes in and says, I found this girl, I'm going to marry her. She's divorced, got two kids, and we're going to get married. She's a Roman Catholic. And you haven't had any input into it, and then, you know, you're picking yourself up off the couch trying to figure out where you went wrong. Well, you forget that. I mean, the guy made his own decisions. He's on his own. He's made decisions that if I ever bought a Ford automobile, my dad would have thought I was nuts. You know, because he didn't like Ford automobiles. I'm sorry. You know, but if I wanted one, that'd be my business. You know. In those situations, the responsibility level's different, and the way you would respond to it would be different too. So it's hard to what I'm saying is, you think the thing through. The thing you want to do is love your children. Teach them that you love them, and love them. And when they fail, you can't make them something that you aren't, and that's perfect. You can't do it. They aren't. You can't require them to be something you're not. Perfect. So you have to deal with them the way you have to be dealt with. In loving understanding. And hey, folks, that's tough. But I would, in a situation like that, set the ground rules as to, I got a problem with this. I'd express it. I'd let them know it. I love you. And I'm going to love your spouse. And the fact that she's not what we are, she's not a believer, I'm not going to love her any less. And I'd go out of my way to demonstrate to her that I value and esteem her as my daughter as much as I value and esteem him as my son, and I want her to know Christ. You understand that? I wouldn't ostracize her. It'd be wrong to do that. It'd be wrong to make. But it also doesn't mean that I have to participate and just make out like there is no difference. And that's a tricky thing, but that's where wisdom has to be applied. Going to the ceremony, I can't tell you what to do about that. I can tell you that I can understand certain circumstances where I would go, but it would be obvious by my not performing the wedding that I was not a part of it. So, it's like my dad when he died. 2 days before he died, he asked me, he said, he was talking about the service, and he'd had it all planned out. Music and everything, some scriptures, and it came time to begin to talk about the message, and I said, well, you don't worry about that, because I'm going to do it. He kind of teared up. He said, well, I'm glad that you said that, because I wanted you to, but I wasn't going to ask you to. I said, well, you don't have any choice. You're not going to be there. I'm going to do it. There are certain things, you know, that you can just step out and take a prerogative on. And my children, I mean, I never asked my boy who was going to marry him. I just told him, well, I'll be there and do it. You know. Well, because that's, but see, we have a relationship over that there are certain things that he would never even think about me not doing. It's the way it is. Just like there are certain things I would never think about him not doing. And that's what you do from the time they're little guys, is you build that relationship so that when they get to be adults, you can have a real adult relationship. You can cut the apron string. And that's tough. You can let them go. same time, still have a committed relationship with them.
I hate to digress from the family. I was wondering if you would comment on 1 Timothy 2:8.
I will, therefore, that men pray everywhere. It's the responsibility of men in the assembly to pray, to do the praying. And, of course, this is in a public service, as the things right after demonstrate. Lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting.
I have basically heard in many of the churches is a very literal interpretation of the first part of that verse, which says that the men pray. But when it gets to the lifting of the holy hands, it's no longer a literal interpretation. Now, is the Bible to be taken literally or not? Or where is the key in understanding that verse?
Well, if it would be, there are two things lifting up holy hands. Number one, you don't have holy hands. So obviously Paul isn't talking about just, it's like when he says with the heart man believes unto righteousness. You know that isn't the ticker. It's used in a different sense. Holy hands, well, in me that is in my flesh dwells no good thing. So obviously he's not talking about a physical posture. The reference there is Exodus 17. The illustration, Moses is out there, Joshua's in the valley fighting the Amalekites. Moses is up on the hill praying. Aaron and Hur are with him. When he lifts up his hands, they win. When his hands go down, he gets weary, type of not praying, they lose. So they sit Moses down on a rock, and they hold up his hands, Aaron on one side, Hur on the other, in order for Israel to win. And that is an illustration of intercessory prayer. Okay? That's the idea there. The reason that they would hold up their hands, Moses' hands, you tell me, why would somebody hold their hands up like that? Think. Somebody up here gonna hand you something down, how would you receive it? Okay, God is going to hand them down something. That's the representation. Okay, God is handing them. That's how Israel got their blessings. That's the whole issue. God is over there in the temple giving them. They're reaching out to receive from God the blessings. Where is God today? He's not out there to hand you or pour you down. I will pour you out a blessing. Malachi 3 talking to Israel. See, I'm going to receive the blessing. The physical posture is a demonstration of all of that is demonstrating the spiritual reality. Okay? I'm going to pour you out the blessing. They're going to receive it. Now, where's God today? He's not off in the temple. He's in here. So if you're going to communicate with the Lord today, it's difficult for me to understand why, if I'm going to receive something from God, I'd be reaching up like he's the holy out yonder. You know, it would be more an internalized, he's in here, and the blessings are coming out. So I take it as the men are going to pray, lifting up holy hands being a without wrath and doubting. Obviously, the issue there is the attitude with which they're doing the thing. And I take the verse to be talking about the intercessory prayer, holy hands being the consecrated men. So that's the character of the men that are involved, men without wrath and doubting, men of sincerity and honesty in the things of the Lord. And it's the kind of intercessory prayer that the men in the church are to carry on. And I don't take it as being that when I pray I'm to be like that. Neither do I take in Ephesians 4 when he says he bows his knee before God that I should be on my knees with my hands up when I pray. It's not.
In Christ Jesus, there is no difference between Greek, Gentile and Jew, slave or free man, etc. Why are we back to what appears to be a position in law that the men only do certain things? Only the men should pray? Only? Or is this just expressing Paul's desire that the men should take the lead?
The
prohibition of women doing any praying?
I don't think women cannot pray. I think women better pray. But in the context, see, it says verse 1, I exhort therefore that first of all, the first issue in the, what he's doing is he's chapter 1, he's talked about the importance of the local church and the ministry that's committed to him, and now he's going to give you instructions about how to operate the local church. First issue in the local church is not an organization, it's a spiritual issue, spiritual life. And that spiritual life is manifested, first of all, that prayer, supplication, intercession, giving of thanks be made for all men. How come you can pray for all men? Verse 4, 5, 6, 7, because Paul has an everyman ministry. Wherefore, verse 8, I therefore, because we have an everyman ministry, that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands. Verse number 9, let the women learn in silence. In other words, he's beginning to, he talks about the men in the assembly, then he talks about the women, then in chapter 3, verse 1, the bishops, chapter 3, verse 8, the deacons, then verse 14, 15, and 16, the whole assembly as a whole. He's talking about you men have responsibilities, you women have responsibilities, the bishops have responsibilities, the deacons have responsibilities. He's not saying that the responsibility the bishop has, nobody but the bishop can teach. Must be apt to teach. He's not saying nobody but the bishop can teach. He said that's what the bishop's supposed to do. That's his job. He has these responsibilities. Okay? All right. When he says that the men are supposed to pray, he's not saying the men are the only people that can pray. He said that's their responsibility. Go do it, guys. I've never been in a group, in an assembly. I've been in a lot of assemblies. I've never been in one where if the men would take the lead, the women didn't say, glory to God, have at it. I've also been in assemblies where women wanted to be leaders. And one of the ways that they exerted that was by taking the men's place of responsibility. So you have to be careful about that. But it doesn't mean that women can't pray, but it means the men are the one who's supposed to do it. So get on with it, guys. And if you've got an hour to pray, and you've got enough men that take 5 hours from all to pray, well then, who ought to be praying? I mean, again, there's that the practical application of what are we going to do and how are we going to do it. Well, let's do it. And if the people that are ought to be taking the lead are doing it, then it's going to just kind of work itself out in the right way. And that's not going to say that we're knocking somebody in the head and we're violating the will of God or something if something else a little different happens. But the thing is that these people whose responsibility it is to do ought to get on with their responsibility. And then things will work smoothly. It'll come internally and go out. So I wouldn't set up a situation where we're going to have prayer meeting and you ladies can't pray. Just turn it off. I'd set a situation up in the prayer meeting and say, okay, guys, we have a responsibility to lead this assembly in audible prayer. Audible prayer is an extremely valuable asset among believers. You ever notice how many times Paul says, I prayed for you, and then he lists the things that he prayed about? You ever wonder why that is? It's important for you to hear the things that I am telling God and thinking before the Lord. It's important for you to hear it. One, it could be an encouragement for you. It might not be such an encouragement. It might be a rebuke to you. It might be some instruction to you. It'll help you understand where I'm at more. All these different things. And audible prayer needs to be done. Needs to be done that way. And it's the men. Hey guys, let's get on. Let's take our responsibility seriously. And let's get on with this. And if you hadn't been doing it, well then let's say, hey, you have responsibility to do it. You only have a finite amount of time. So that's going to... Now somebody said, well, does that mean that all the men have to pray before a lady can pray? And what you're saying, let's get on with the thing. Let's the guys take the lead and let's go do it. And if the men will go do it, what will happen is that it will fall in line. And it won't be a situation. It will be, hey, man, this thing's working. We're cooking. And that will be that internal life manifesting itself out. when it says in verse 9, verse 11, let the women learn in silence, that doesn't mean a woman can't say anything. You know how I know that? Acts chapter 22, Paul beckons to the crowd, and they keep the more silence. Well, how do you have more silence? If you have silence, and silence is, you didn't say a word, how do you have more not saying a word? He's talking about quietness. They got more quiet. They got more silent. It isn't that there's, you don't even grunt. Where I went to church when I was a kid, when you went in the auditorium, if you had to sneeze, you were embarrassed. If you had to, I mean, it was so formal and stiff. That's the reason I'm sort of loose, because I just rebel against all that. And if you went up to the communion and you took communion and you knelt down and your knees cracked, I mean, honestly, as a 10-year-old kid, I used to sit on the front row, right, the second row right there, when we had communion, and we'd sit up there just to hear how many adults' knees cracked. Because that was the, you know, that was exciting, because you weren't supposed to make it noise of any kind, whispering, oops. And it'd be 600 people, then it'd be so quiet if you went to, you know, if you must whisper a prayer. I think, man, you go out there just wrung out, man. That kind of stuff.